This is Dr. Michael Bricky with Ageless Lifestyles Radio, cutting-edge thinking for being youthful at every age. On each program, I interview experts on what it takes to live longer, healthier, and happier. Today's show is The Easiest and Best Way to Get Fit with strength exercise expert Frederick Hahn. Frederick Hahn is co-author of The Slow Burn Revolution and author of Strong Kids, Healthy Kids. My dream exercise regime would be to only have to exercise once or twice a week at home for only half an hour, barely sweat, not be bored, and end up strong and healthy. That was a nice fantasy, and then along came Frederick Hahn and showed me how to do it. Fred, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike. Nice to be with you, talk to you today.
The key to your fitness system and weight loss system is to get us to fail and fail again and again and again. Why is it so important to get our muscles to fail?
Well, you know, actually at the gym we call it muscular success. But the word failure, we use that word because the word failure is such a negative word, but by failure, by reaching the point where the muscles are unable to continue lifting a resistance, whether it's a weight, a dumbbell, your body weight, doing pull-ups or push-ups, we're stimulating all of the available muscle fibers to become stronger. So, for example, if you go to the gym and you do some exercise for your legs and you pick a weight and you do 10 repetitions and you stop voluntarily at that 10th repetition, we know for a fact that you have not engaged all of the available muscle fibers. And more specifically, you haven't engaged the most important of the muscle fibers, important meaning for increased strength and increasing the amount of muscle tissue that you have, which are called the fast twitch, so to speak, muscle fibers. Fast does not refer to the speed with which you move, but the degree to which they fatigue. So if you can do 12 repetitions when you're lifting a weight, you should, and you should even attempt the 13th. And if the 13th is, in good form, not possible, you can be rest assured. It's like your guarantee that you have engaged all of the available muscle fibers and done your very best to increase your strength and muscle mass to the greatest degree possible.
So your muscles get recruited in a sequence, and you're not going to get to all of the fast twitch muscles unless you totally fatigue your muscles.
Right. The muscle fibers contract in an orderly, it's actually called the orderly recruitment theory. And theory meaning the first definition of theory, which means fact. There are two definitions of theory, but we won't get into that. So it is a fact. We know for a fact that the fast twitch muscle fibers are only engaged at the very last part of an exercise when you are fatiguing the muscle as deeply as possible. So successive sets, meaning you do 10 repetitions and you rest, you do another 10, you do another 10, when you could have done 12 or 13, doesn't get to those muscle fibers. You're just stimulating the same muscle fibers over and over and over again. So it's better to perform one set to complete fatigue than it is to perform multiple sets not to fatigue. Well, I shouldn't say better in the sense that multiple sets don't produce benefits. They do. But a single set to complete fatigue is all you need to do. That's why it can be so time efficient.
Well, that's what's going to grow the muscles. And do I understand that the fast twitch muscles, the last ones to get recruited, are the ones that are the biggest key to strength and athletic performance?
Yes, yes, as I mentioned before, and you're absolutely right. And even for seniors who are not athletes, who just need to get up out of a chair better, who are having a hard time getting out of the car, those fast twitch muscle fibers are the ones that are going to help them the very most. And one of the unfortunate things as we grow older is if we spend too long away from performing an exercise that is strenuous enough to stimulate those fibers will actually atrophy and to the point where they vanish. And that's the last thing we want to have happen. But the good news is that by performing exercises the way I'm suggesting, you can rejuvenate them and bring them back to life.
And there have been several studies of people who were in wheelchairs or bedridden that took on strength training programs and regained the strength to walk again.
Absolutely. In fact, I'm working with a gentleman now who was, when I first started training him, he was about 74 years old. He trained with me straight for 5 years, and we were able to keep him mobile, and to look at him walking around, you'd was walking around like a 50-year-old. Then he was not available to continue his training due to factors that were beyond his control, and he just came back at 84 years old, and the difference, it was quite marked. And now, only after about 10 sessions with us, he no longer needs his cane to walk around in the gym, which he did before. He can actually get down the stairs on his own, where before he could not. And that's only in 10, 20-minute sessions. So he's now gaining back his mobility and gaining back his life.
And what you teach just turns conventional thinking about fitness on its head. For example, we're taught that you need cardio to strengthen your heart, and you say no on two counts.
Right, right. There is no exercise that actually strengthens your heart. Your heart doesn't get any stronger in response to exercise. It gets more efficient at pumping blood, but that has much more to do with the muscles that are becoming more efficient at extracting oxygen from the blood than actually making the heart stronger.
And people now, you're talking about body muscles, not heart muscles.
Right, skeletal muscles. So the reason why someone walks up three or four flights of stairs and gets out of breath, but after doing aerobic exercise for, say, a month or two or three, now can walk up those same flights of steps with ease, is not because anything happened to the heart or lungs. What happened was that the muscles of the legs became more efficient at pulling oxygen from the blood so that they increase their endurance. They're more able to perform endurance-type activities with greater ease. Now, strength training does that same thing, but better, and also the added benefits that, of that strength training gives you. So when you perform aerobic activity, yes, you get benefit, but when you strength train, you get those same benefits from aerobic activity and much, much more. So for the listeners, I'm not saying, and let me repeat, I am not saying that you should not take a nice walk, ride your bike, swim in the pool. I am not saying that you shouldn't do those things. What I am saying is that resistance training gives you all the benefits of those activities and much, much more.
To me, it's counterintuitive in that I think of the heart as a muscle, and if you use that muscle, particularly using your own theory, all out, you would think that that would make the heart muscle stronger.
Yeah, the only difference there is, though, even though the heart's a muscle, it's also an involuntary organ. It's not like a skeletal muscle, and actually the structure of the fibers are completely different. By overworking your heart as an involuntary organ, you can make the analogy to overworking your liver or overworking your spleen. Or anytime you make an involuntary organ work hard for long periods of time, you never strengthen it. In almost all cases, you weaken it. And we know from research that intense amounts of aerobic activity actually accelerate the aging process hormonally and actually cause more detriment than benefit. So again, taking a nice walk around the park, riding your bike around the park, taking a swim in the pool, those are very gentle physical activities that are very beneficial to the skeletal muscles, not to the heart and lungs. But when people jog for 3, 4, 5 miles every day, thinking that they're actually improving their heart and their lungs and their longevity, they're mistaken. Research does not support that at all, and in fact shows the opposite.
So the strategy for good heart health is to not tax your heart, and that's why they put heart patients on beta blockers.
Right, and in fact the best strategy for a healthy heart is to, as I think everyone knows, is to not smoke and to eat a diet that is very, very low in refined carbohydrates. You know, there's a lot of research now that shows that arteriosclerosis, arteriosclerosis, heart disease, is much more an outcome of internal inflammation. And a recent paper came out on saturated fats showing that the total amount of dietary saturated fat in your diet has absolutely nothing to do with heart disease at all or any cardiovascular disease. In fact, more saturated fat in the diet was shown, and more cholesterol was shown to actually have a beneficial effect. So hopefully that myth will vanish as swiftly as possible, and people will start getting on the right track diet-wise.
As if you hadn't turned our beliefs upside down enough. So you're saying saturated fat is not bad for us?
It is very, 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 very healthy for you. And it was demonized 30, 40 years ago or more by doctors. Ansel Keys was perhaps the key player in the saturated fat, cholesterol, heart health hypothesis. He was out to prove, whenever a scientist is out to prove anything, you know you're in trouble. He was out to prove that specifically saturated fats and cholesterol were the demons and the direct cause of cardiovascular disease. There wasn't any science to prove it then, or even suggest it then, and there isn't any science to prove it or suggest it now. And in fact, the research now shows that excessive carbohydrate, sugar, glucose flowing throughout the body is the culprit. And there is research on that, and it is not only the culprit for cardiovascular disease, but also for obesity and type 2 diabetes.
Well, I'm seeing a lot of consensus on inflammation as being the underlying cause of all chronic diseases, or virtually
right.
all chronic diseases,
mm-hmm.
and certainly a discrediting of cholesterol as a major factor.
Right.
But I haven't seen much about the saturated fat.
Yeah, there is a lot of information on it. The actual paper that had just recently came out on it, I can't think of it off the top of my head. I wonder if I left it on my desktop. But it is a very large epi study.
If you email me the reference, I'll put it on my website.
I will do that, absolutely.
Another thing that you turn on its head is flexibility. And mm-hmm. you're supposed to stretch before you exercise, let's do yoga.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, no.
Right. Muscular flexibility is a bit of a misnomer in the sense that it is an incorrect usage of the word. Muscles don't flex. I mean, you say, oh, flex your muscle, you know. That's just a common phrase. That is a misuse of the word. Joints flex, and this is not semantics, this is biomechanics. Joints flex. Muscles contract and uncontract. You cannot increase the length of the muscle into the non-contractile recesses of the tendon. Maybe it goes from muscle to tendon, tendon to bone, by stretching.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, say the innocent lie that the Pilates people tell you is that by performing lengthening exercises as they do, you can actually create longer, leaner muscles. That is the only person who can do that is a surgeon, and they would have to remove the muscle from your bone and then lengthen it and then re-sew it further down on the... But, of course, that's ridiculous. So, no, stretching and research, again, supports this, and more research is coming out to support the fact that stretching does absolutely nothing of what it claims to do, and in fact, in athletes, can actually be detrimental. Think of it as taking your car springs, and if you were to stretch them and stretch them and stretch them, and then put them back on the car, you'd actually make the car more unstable because those springs would be all stretched out. They wouldn't be tight, so that when you make a turn, the springs keep that front end, keep the car's chassis nice and tight to the road. If the springs are all loosey-goosey, you are in for an accident. And the same thing happens to athletes, and that's why I don't have facts on this, but I strongly believe that the reason why so many athletes, especially women, today are getting hamstring pulls and injuries of that sort is because of the emphasis on stretching programs that athletic trainers and personal trainers and coaches force upon their athletes. Strength training improves the ability of muscles to move throughout a range of motion. So when you see, say, a senior who reaches up to the highest shelf to pull down a can of, say, baked beans, and can hardly reach it. A physical therapist might look at that senior and say, oh my God, look how tight he is. He needs some stretching. When really, he's just weak. Muscles move joints throughout the normal range of motion of that joint. And that's what improves when you perform a sound strength training program. So strength training improves joint flexibility by improving muscular contractility so that you can do whatever it is you wish to do in life. That said, yes, if you want to be a ballerina, if you want to be a karate master, if you want to be a gymnast, You have to stretch because what stretching in that case does is lengthens the ligament. Like when I said about pulling the car apart, lengthens the ligaments, which have very little blood flow, so that the body can move it so that the joints have a better ability to move through extreme ranges. But the typical person doesn't want that. That's not good. And you can see that athletes like that in their older age, once they hit 40, 45, 50, they have a lot of joint problems. So yes, stretching is good for those types of extreme sports, but it should be avoided by a typical person, and it becomes completely unnecessary because strength training gives you all the benefits that you need in order to move your joints about throughout a normal range of motion.
When we roll out of bed in the morning, if we're feeling a little stiff, should we do some stretching?
Well, here's the thing. Far be it for me to tell you what to do, but whatever makes you feel good, if it feels good to stretch, go ahead and stretch. Like with aerobics, if you like to run, you like to jog, by all means, one should enjoy oneself. But one should understand what those activities are actually providing, what they're actually doing. So if it feels good to stretch in the morning, stretch, by all means. The beauty of strength training, however, is you'll find that if you're a person who gets up in the morning and you're stiff and you're tight and it takes you 10 or 15 minutes of moving your joints about to get the synovial fluid and the fluids moving, you'll find that after, I would say, as little as 2 to 3 weeks of strength training, properly, of course, you will not get out of the bed feeling like that or anywhere near to that same degree. It really basically boils down to when we get older, we get weaker. And when we get weaker, everything that was easy to do becomes harder to do. So the focus of all people's exercise programs should be resistance training of some kind. It doesn't have to be even the way I suggest that you do it, although I believe very strongly that the way I suggest people do it is the safest way to do it and the most efficient way to do it and a highly effective way to do it, but obviously there are other ways. So once you make resistance training your foundation, and you do it properly, everything else then becomes adjunct. And you can do it because you want to do it. I cannot tell you the amount of clients that have said to me, oh, my yoga class, I've never been able to do these things in yoga, and now I can. Don't get tennis elbow anymore when I play tennis. Things of this nature. Mm-hmm. So it's just looking at things, giving things their proper perspective, doing things for the reason, for real reasons, and then moving on from there.
While we're on flexibility, does getting a massage have any effect on your system?
I worked as a physical therapy aide at the Hospital for Joint Disease and Sports Medicine Center for a few years, and I ran my own physical therapy clinic with an orthopedic surgeon. And what is true about massage is that you can have scar tissue that builds up within and around the muscle tendinous unit. And scar tissue can tend to be immobilizing, meaning that it gets in the way of your ability to move your body, your joints, and your muscles. So there are techniques, that very valid techniques, that physical therapists and doctors and athletic trainers use and massage therapists use in order to, quote-unquote, break up and mobilize the scar tissue and, you know, what's typically called knots in the muscle.
Mm-hmm.
So certainly, yeah, absolutely. I think that massage is a wonderful modality. It's a passive modality, right? It's not an active modality. It's a passive modality to the person. Passive modalities have their place, but it's very important, again, and I think people really, most people, because they don't do any resistance training, they just don't know how good they can feel and how much better they can feel if they engage in a sound resistance training program. And I think because there's a stigma attached to resistance training, and that stigma is that if I do resistance training, I'll get big, bulky, ugly muscles, I'll get tight. All of those things that come along with, you know, I'll look like Arnold and stuff like that, which is just, it's silly, it's not true. It's unfortunate that that myth has taken hold. You know, Mark Twain said, the truth is easy to kill, but a lie well told is immortal.
Well, there was probably some truth to that in that a lot of people probably did resistance training wrong and emphasized just the muscles that would make them look good and so got very unbalanced.
Well, actually, I mean, I know what you're saying, and to a degree you're correct, but actually, no. There is no way to lift weights incorrectly to make your muscles big and bulky and tight. Genetics dictate whether or not you're going to have big, bulky muscles or whether you're going to have a more lean-like warrior physique. It's completely a matter of genetics. So in women, especially with women, they'll say, well, I want to get big and bulky. I would say, Mary, if you begged me and said money's no object, I want the biggest muscle, I want to look like a man, it's virtually impossible. It's virtually impossible for most men to look like Arnold Schwarzenegger. That's drugs and genetics. So if you do a strength training program wrong, you can get hurt. That's the worst part of it. But big and bulky, never going to happen.
That was one of the interesting messages from the slow burn revolution, was that genetics plays a big role, and if you're not genetically born that way, you're not going to look like the muscle magazines, and right. If you're not genetically born that way, you're not going to be a great athlete in whatever the sport
right.
is.
That's right. That's just. I mean, you know, we all know little kids who are really, really, really good at math, much better than we are as adults, or who are really, really good at art. No one taught them. They're wired for it. Or little kids who can sing. They never took a singing class in their life, and they open their mouth and this beautiful sound and tone comes out. Never took a class. They have no idea what they're doing. It's a gift that they were given. So, or very, very Paul Newman bright blue eyes. These are obvious genetic benefits, or I guess you could say, but what's not obvious is big muscles, because people think, oh, if I lift weights, I get big muscles. But that would be like saying, if I bounce a basketball, I'll get tall. It's genetics. Mm-hmm. And we just have to accept what we have, and when we perform our exercises properly and eat properly, you know, like I always just say to my daughter, you get what you get, and don't get upset.
Another myth, you talked about how heart muscles don't get bigger with exercise, and you say you're not going to increase your lung capacity either
right.
by exercising.
Your heart actually can become enlarged. Think of it like if mm-hmm. you do a biceps curl with an exercise, temporarily the biceps becomes larger because it's full of blood, it's pumped, so to speak. That can happen to the heart with chronic aerobic exercise, and an enlarged heart, well, they call it an enlarged heart in someone who doesn't exercise, and they call it an athlete's heart in someone who does. But if I took the heart out of the body of the athlete and showed it to a doctor and said, hey, doc, look at this, he would say, oh, my gosh, that's an enlarged heart. That's not good. But if I said, oh, but I took it out of that runner, the doctor then all of a sudden says, oh, you took it out of the runner. But the truth of the matter is, it doesn't make a hill of beans a difference. An enlarged heart is an enlarged heart, and that is not good. And that goes back to what we were talking about before, how overdoing aerobic exercises or chronic aerobic activity, just like chronic resistance training, you can lift weights too much too, you know,
mm-hmm.
Can cause symptoms of overtraining, hormonal dysfunction, increase the aging process. You know, people say, well, what am I going to do if I don't exercise? I say, you want to know something to do? Take a nap.
So cardiomegaly is cardiomegaly, whether you're an athlete or 300 pounds and out of shape.
Yeah, the only difference is that the athlete has improved the mitochondria within the muscle cells,
mm-hmm.
whereas the person who, let's say, has an enlarged heart due to a poor diet or has a genetic malformation or some other issue that has caused it does not. And that's why, again, you know, I say that you can point to many, many athletes that were highly, highly conditioned who still got heart attacks. There is no aerobic exercise does not protect, help, do anything specifically to the heart, except hurt it if you do it too much.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with strength exercise expert Frederick Hahn, H-A-H-N, co-author of The Slow Burn Revolution and author of Strong Kids, Healthy Kids. His website is SeriousStrength.com, and Serious Strength is also the name of his fitness center in New York City. And on SeriousStrength.com, you can find out about his blogs and tweets. And I noticed you did a tweet about Michelle Obama's obesity and exercise program for children.
Yeah, I just did a blog post on the Huffington Post about it. I listened to and saw the show on Good Morning America. It's just such a shame because, you know, her heart is in the right place. I mean, mm-hmm. she means well. She really wants to do right by children. But unfortunately, she's being fed the same misinformation about why children and adults, but specifically children, are obese and what the solution to it is. And children are getting fatter than ever before, even though we're saying, oh, you know, exercise more and eat less fat. One of the definitions of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different outcome. I wish I could get the ear of the First Lady and let her to try and help her to understand the science rather than the lore on obesity. But it's going to be a tough battle if people in her position and other people who are as influential as her are continuing to spout the same old, same old. It's one thing to mislead, innocently mislead adults. It's quite another to do it to children. So,
well, I'd love to see you do a challenge on some major television program where one group goes through a regime of somebody else and one group of kids goes through your regime and document the results.
Well, I actually proposed that to the producers of The Biggest Loser, and I actually proposed that to Dr. Mehmet Oz, Oprah Winfrey's doctor. I was on his show. I proposed it to both people, and believe it or not, both people fell on deaf ears. No one was in the least bit interested, which is, again, it's another shame. The more I'm in this business, the more I see how it's people's agenda. People are more interested in what they're going to get out of it than they are about the subjects discussed themselves. I've been on a few shows where I've discussed the issue of adolescent obesity and said, in fact, that overfat, I like to call it overfat, not obese, overfat children are not less active than their lean counterparts. In fact, I'll read you a sentence real quick from the book, the textbook, Childhood Obesity, Society for the Study of Human Biology, Contemporary Issues. This book came out in 2007, and on page 125 it says this: "It is thus possible to be an obese yet active child, or a normal weight but relatively sedentary child. At present, we do not know the future consequences of physical activity levels for either of these groups." And it even goes on to talk about how lean young girls are less active than obese boys. So if activity has anything to do with obesity, why aren't all girls obese then? In other words, they're trying to say that, well, look, these obese boys are less active than these lean boys, so therefore the less activity has something to do with their obesity. Yet when they look at the girls, all girls in the studies that they've done are less active than the boys, even the obese boys. So now why doesn't the First Lady have this information? Why doesn't she know this? Why isn't this on television? I would love a debate where we could sit down and actually talk about the science behind it, meaning that the moderator would say, no one's allowed to say anything that is their opinion. We are only allowed to discuss science. That's something that I would relish.
Mm-hmm. Now, your distinction between overfat and obese, what's the difference?
Well, in the sense that overfat as opposed to overweight, weight isn't the issue. Fat is the issue. You can have a very large boned boy or girl who technically on the BMI scale is obese, yet the amount of body fat that they have on their body is not excessive. So using BMI as a scale, height-weight ratio, is not always going to be a proper test of whether or not the child has too much fat on their body. Same for adults. Technically, I'm almost obese, even though my body fat percentage is 10%. And that's because I have so much lean mass.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more accurate to describe the child as overfat than overweight or obese.
Okay.
I like getting technical.
Sometimes you have to get technical to make the distinctions and get it right.
I think so. It's too much information on the subject of obesity and exercise and fitness in general are vagaries, which is one of the reasons why so many people feel as if there's so much misinformation out there. And there is misinformation out there because no one is being specific. No one is taking the time to look at what we actually know about the subject rather than what we believe. I even had a woman at a conference say to me after I was explaining pretty much what I'm explaining to you and the listeners right now, she looked at me and she shook her head and she said, "Well, I have my own science." You know what I mean? That kind of mentality is out there, and it's a crying shame.
I keep wondering, how did the fitness industry miss this? And you were saying that some of it is people have agendas. Some of it is that people aren't specific enough to find accurate answers. But the fitness centers themselves, the personal trainers, how did they miss it? Because if they could have gotten the results, you would have think it would have been a no-brainer that people would flock to them.
Yes, well, it's a good question. When you have, like a doctor, you go to medical school and you learn what you learn. But you're not necessarily learning all of the right things, all of the things that research and science has to offer. Most doctors will tell you that if you have diabetes, you should cut the fat out of your diet, when fat does not raise insulin levels or blood sugar levels at all. Why should I cut the fat out of my diet? Why aren't I cutting the carbohydrates out of my diet? Diabetes is a disorder, a problem, the person's body to deal with glucose, with sugar. The only macronutrient that increases our blood sugar is carbohydrate. You'd think that a doctor would know that. The American Dietetics Association certainly should, but what are they recommending? They recommend that 55% of a diabetic's diet should come from carbohydrate. And if blood sugar can't be controlled, you know what they suggest? This is on their website. They suggest that you sprinkle insulin on your sweets. How about suggesting not to eat the sweets? It's an agenda, of course. Personal trainers are no different. They learn what they learn from their certification agencies. And their certification agency, the American College of Sports Medicine specifically, states that for a beginner you do single sets, for advanced in athletics you need to do multiple sets, when all of the research on the subject of single versus multiple sets of an exercise shows that multiple sets are not more effective. All of the research, except for maybe one or two studies out of the 80 studies that exist on the comparison between single versus multiple sets. Papers have been written in defense of this, against multiple sets by top PhDs and sent to the American College of Sports Medicine, and it falls on deaf ears. So in other words, so many of these agencies, including medical schools, they're not interested in what science has to say. They're more interested in, unfortunately, dogma about commonly held beliefs on exercise and diet.
The Slow Burn Revolution you co-authored with two physicians, what role did they play in the book and the theory?
Well, Mike and Mary Dan Eads are brilliant physicians who I was very lucky to meet and work with after reading the book Protein Powered, which is their New York Times bestselling book. They were the first doctors that who had ever written, and this is specifically what they wrote, was aerobic exercise is good, but it does not offer the additional benefits of strength training. I had never read anything by any doctors who made that statement. I was thrilled to read it and immediately tried to find out who they were and if I could contact them, and one thing led to another, and we formed an intellectual partnership and wrote the Slow Burn Fitness Revolution. And the slow burn actually refers to slow, which is how you perform the strength training exercises. You know, rather than doing push-ups as quickly as you can, do them as slowly as you can, and you'll feel the difference right from the very first push-up. And burn, which has to do with burning body fat, which comes most efficiently, which comes from adopting a diet that is adequate in protein, higher in healthy fats, and much, much, much lower in carbohydrates. When insulin is kept low by keeping carbohydrates low, free fatty acids become liberated from the fat cell at a greater rate than lowering total calories and keeping carbohydrate levels high. So while lowering total calories works, it works because by default you're lowering the total amount of sugar or carbohydrate in your diet. There's no such thing as a calorie receptor. Bodies don't know calories. They only know fat, protein, and carbohydrate. And they have an effect on your, they have different effects on your metabolism. That's why a calorie is not a calorie. And the statement, you are what you eat, is incorrect. The correct statement is, you are what your body does with what you eat. And your body does different things with fat, protein, and carbohydrate in different amounts. And that concept is being completely lost on the American public, and it's something that the Eads understand perhaps better than anyone. So their contribution, of course, their main contribution was the dietary portion of the book. I thought that the match between a low-carbohydrate diet and strength training is probably the most potent and powerful method to improve your health, decrease body fat, and improve your strength and endurance.
And I don't remember if it was your website or their website had a food pyramid that was rather jarring the first time you look at it. The bottom of the food pyramid was all meats and fish and other protein.
Eggs, yeah.
And then the second level was basically dairy, and the carbs were just a tiny little area high on the pyramid.
Right. You know, what's interesting about carbohydrates is that if you go to the dietary reference intakes for energy, carbohydrate, fiber, and fat, and cholesterol, this is, you know, the government, it's called a DRI report. On page 275, it says this: the lower limit of dietary carbohydrate compatible with life is zero, provided that adequate amounts of protein and fat are consumed. Zero. So then let me ask you this, and let me ask all the listeners this. If the government has discovered through science that the lower limit of dietary carbohydrate compatible with life is zero, why then do they make carbohydrate 80% of what we should be eating? That just doesn't add up. What the human body needs, all humans need, and there's very little difference in human beings across the world, is fats and proteins. That's what we subsist upon. Think of the Eskimo. Think of the Inuit. The peoples of the colder climates in Greenland not only survived, but thrived on diets that were primarily fat and protein, virtually devoid of plant matter, or grains certainly, well, which is plant matter, virtually devoid of plant matter. They thrived on it and lived quite robustly without it. So what the food pyramid should really be, the bottom of the, if you're going to use a food pyramid at all, the bottom of the food pyramid should be the foods that the human body requires the most of to survive robustly. And that macronutrient is fat and protein. And the rest is superfluous. I mean, sure, you want to have a salad, you want to have some fruit, no, why not? But the majority of what a human being should be eating is fish, meats, eggs, those kinds of protein sources. We know this to be true from research. Dr. Lauren Cordain, who wrote The Paleo Diet and The Paleo Diet for Athletes, he's a quite brilliant PhD. He and his group have done a lot of research on the subject. And across the board, if you look at all of the peoples of the earth and the diets that they had, from the time we had enough information to study it, virtually 70 to 80% of the human diet consisted of fats and proteins, and the rest from carbohydrate.
We'll get back to Frederick Kahn in just a moment. Frederick Kahn challenges conventional thinking about physical fitness. I challenge conventional thinking about aging. I love doing keynotes, seminars, and consulting that challenges conventional thinking about aging and gets people to adopt beliefs that help them think, feel, look, and be more youthful. When you think younger, it shows in your posture, demeanor, facial expressions, and energy level. When you feel better, you look more youthful and attractive. And when that happens, people even treat you better. If your business or organization is considering a speaker or consultant to improve morale and productivity, let me help you and your employees or colleagues think, feel, look, and be more youthful. Check out my demo video at anti-aging-speaker.com. That's anti-aging-speaker.com. Or give me a call. My phone number is on all my websites. And now back to Frederick Kahn. To put this in perspective, if you had your ideal diet, how would that compare to what Atkins was recommending?
Well, Atkins was recommending a diet that had been around for well over 100 years. The Atkins diet is nothing new. Atkins just reformulated it in modern language to get across the idea that it is sugar, it is carbohydrate that is the villain in body fat because it raises insulin. And insulin, one of the major roles of insulin is to regulate blood sugar, but the other major role of insulin is to store body fat and not only store it more efficiently, keep the free fatty acids locked in the fat cell. There was a book written in 1875, I think it was, and it was called A Letter on Corpulence. Maybe it was 1865. In fact, I just pulled it out of my library here. 1864, Letter on Corpulence by William Banting. And he was an obese man who could not lose any weight. finally found a doctor who said, your problem, my friend, is sugar, carbohydrate. No more bread, no more scones, no more beer. And as soon as he, and to eat fatty meats as freely as he would like. In other words, don't count calories. Eat all the fatty meat that you like. Just get rid of the carbohydrates as much as you can, other than a salad or something of that nature. And he wrote about this and successfully was able to lose body fat, and to a great degree, without having to feel deprived, which is a very important point about losing body fat. So Atkins' ideas was just regurgitated information from 100 years prior. So when people call the Atkins diet or the low-carb diet a fad diet, that's only because they don't know the history. The fad diet really is the government food pyramid. That's the fad diet, if ever there was one.
Also, to put things in perspective, Barry Sears's Zone Diet wants a balance between the three. Do you see that as an ideal diet, or do you think he has too much carbs in them?
There's too much carbs. I mean, he has an agenda, of course, because he needs to sell his books and his way of doing things. But his diet is not supported in scientific research to be the very best or optimal diet. Not that we know what the optimal diet is, but it certainly isn't his. There was a research study that came out a few years ago comparing the Atkins diet to the Sears diet to the Ornish diet to, I think it was a Mediterranean. It was called the A to Z study, meaning A to Z, meaning they looked at all the popular diets and compared them. And at the end of the study, the Atkins diet was by far and away the superior diet, not just in terms of fat loss, but in terms of improvements in internal health markers like blood pressure, HDL cholesterol, and things of that nature. And the only reason why it wasn't even better than it was because for some crazy reason, at the end of the year, at the six-month mark, the people in the Atkins diet started to increase their total amount of dietary carbohydrate. And as their total amount of dietary carbohydrate increased, you can see little by little by little their loss of body fat slowed and started to reverse. So had the Atkins diet people kept to their low levels of carbohydrate, although they were eating about the same amount of calories that the other groups were eating, they would have gotten even better results. And the reason is very, very simple. When you keep insulin and sugar low, fatty acids inside the fat cell are free to escape. When you don't, they're less free. And it's metabolism. It's biochemistry. We don't get to vote. It's a fact. It's too bad that the media label the Atkins diet as a fad and that they say that it's heart unhealthy when there's no evidence to suggest that is true. And in fact, that study that I was talking about was called The Questionable Role of Saturated and Polyunsaturated Fatty Acids in Cardiovascular Disease by Dr. Uffe Ravenskov, who's a MD, PhD, award-winning MD, PhD. It was in the Journal of Clinical Epidemiology. So it's important to understand that, like what I said before, it's not you are what you eat. You are what your body does with what you eat. And what your body does with carbohydrates in excess is allow your body to store more body fat and keep it locked there.
So people who want to lose weight, the key is low carbohydrates and the slow burn exercise. Could you explain how slow burn increases your metabolism and helps you lose weight just from the change in muscles?
Sure. Well, first let me say that if you're interested in losing body fat, if you have too much body fat on your body and you want to lose it, diet is how you eat, meaning low carbohydrate diets, adequate fats and proteins, is 99.9% of the battle. Exercise has virtually nothing to do with successfully losing the body fat that you want. I'll repeat, it has virtually nothing to do with it. Don't look to exercise to help you lose body fat. It will not work. Now, exercise does other things. And what you just mentioned, Mike, was that it improves metabolic rate. It does, but not to an enormous degree. In other words, you shouldn't rely on that. But it does help. So when you increase the amount of lean tissue, meaning bone density and muscle tissue on your body, your metabolic rate increases, meaning the amount of calories that you burn at rest goes up. But it really it's more for slow burn strength training, and strength training in general is more for reasons of daily activity, being able to do things better, being able to pick up that kitty litter without throwing your bag out, being able to ride your bike with your children without having to feel like you're out of breath and you can't go, things of that nature. That's what strength training is for, more than anything else. And it also helps to regulate, if you are diabetic, it helps regulate blood sugar. So does aerobic exercise. But strength training also does that very, very well as well. So I know many exercise enthusiasts will say, oh, yeah, and I know Jillian Michaels on The Biggest Loser. I mean, I personally think that show is just a crime. But, you know, it's entertainment, isn't it? I mean, I think it's terrible entertainment. But exercise is completely unnecessary for successfully losing body fat. It's important for other reasons, though, of course.
And I did want to touch on bones, that the strength exercise is one of the best things you can do for strong bones.
Yeah.
You said you also need calcium, phosphorus, magnesium, and boron.
Well, your minerals. You want to make sure that you're getting your daily mineral intake. And rather than taking supplements, which you can, you're better off not eating the kinds of foods that rob you of those important minerals. And that food source, believe it or not, we don't really have enough time to talk about this issue, I don't think, is grain products. Grain products, especially refined grain products, rob the body and leach the body of many minerals that are very important for health. One of the suggestions that we give all of our clients when they're trying to become healthier in order to lose body fat successfully is to remove all grain products from their diet. That's a whole other myth and a whole other marketing scheme that has worked really, really well, which is that whole grains are healthy for you and they should make up a large part of a healthy diet. Whole grains are terrible for you. They rob you. They are the single most nutrient void food that a human being can eat. And one of the reasons is because we, even though, for example, wheat does have certain vitamins and minerals in it, the body cannot extract them from those foods very efficiently, if at all. Other animals can, like herbivores. They have the enzymes to break down cellulose. They're designed to eat grass and plants in large quantities. We're not. So what you don't want to do is eat a large amount of food that is going to not only not give you the nutrients you need, but actually force the body to be robbed of essential nutrients. So if you really want to get your calcium levels higher and your bones denser, get rid of your grain. No more bagels. No more pasta. No more toast.
If people want to study up on this, is the Eads book on protein power the one of the best sources? Or?
Yeah, I would say the Protein Power Life Plan, Protein Power or the Protein Power Life Plan would definitely be the go-to book to start with. It's written very, very, very well. I'm jealous of how well they write.
Mm-hmm.
And very easy to understand. And the Protein Power Life Plan book is good because the end of each chapter has what's called the bottom line. So you can just kind of skim through the book and read the bottom line if you don't want to read the whole book at the end of each chapter. Just like take it into the bathroom, leave it off to the side, and read the bottom line, which is two or three pages usually that sums up the entire, like crib notes, sums up the entire chapter. And then from there, if something really, really floats your boat and hits you, you can then read that chapter. That certainly is a great place to start.
To wrap up, we didn't give a real good picture of what the exercises look like.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the way you can do them either at home or at the gym. Could you give
us a
little sketch of what a 30-minute workout would look like?
Right. Well, for people who already work out and are familiar with the gym or familiar with doing push-ups and sit-ups, the way in which you would perform them is on a very, very slow count. So, for example, if you're doing push-ups, you'd want to start with your chest touching the ground with your hands shoulder-wide apart, knees or toes on the ground, whichever way you prefer to do the push-up. And then rather than push yourself up as fast as possible, push yourself up as slowly as possible. And that will be, in other words, take a minimum of about 6 to 7 seconds to go from the start position to where your elbows are straight, and then the same amount of time to lower yourself back down. So we say take a minimum of about a second or two to move the first inch. Continue slowly. You'll complete the push-up in 6, 7, 8 seconds, and then lower yourself back down and continue in that fashion until the muscles are completely and utterly spent to where you cannot push your chest off the ground for one, even a half an inch. Now, for people who are not familiar with the gym or not familiar with exercising, it's a little bit difficult to explain how to do these things, and that's why I wrote the book in a fashion that is easily understandable by anybody. I left all the physio babble and complicated instructions out of it, but I think most people understand what a push-up is, so hopefully that description I gave people enough of a mental picture of how to do it, and you would do that with every other exercise that you do, leg exercises, any arm exercise, any sit-ups, any exercise at all. So the idea is, rather than invoking momentum and letting gravity do the work, you want to force your muscles to do all of the work all of the time.
And your website has a set of three DVDs that also illustrate the exercises.
Yes, and actually on the website there's a free PDF download. The website is www.seriousstrength.com, and if you look around on the top menu bar and you look at books and items, you'll see a free PDF download that is about a 10 or 15 page description of how to do the exercises and what it's all about. So without even having to buy the book at all, you could just download that PDF and it'll give you some good information. And then from there, if you like what it has to say, you can always buy the book or buy the home workout. The DVDs, by the way, are a home workout. They're not for the gym. They're just for if you're in your hotel room or if you don't have a gym membership, then you can utilize the slow burn system in the privacy of your own home.
And the download is a very good overview. I was impressed with it. We're talking with exercise expert Frederick Hahn, co-author of The Slow Burn Revolution and author of Strong Kids, Healthy Kids. The website, again, is seriousstrength.com, Serious Strength being the name of his fitness center in New York City. Boy, I think everybody ought to at least give it a try and see what kind of results they get.
Yeah, well, I would say to everybody who's listening now to the show, I like to put this last thought into people's heads. Resistance training or strength training is very, very important. You will not believe how good you feel if you engage in a proper strength training program twice a week. It doesn't have to be my way, but I urge everyone, especially those who are type 2 diabetic, to engage in a sound resistance training program twice a week. As little as 15 to 20 minutes is really all you need. And from a diet perspective, to not believe the government food pyramid, it is simply not true. And the low-fat, no-fat, high-carbohydrate diet is responsible for the prevalence of obesity and type 2 diabetes that is continuing to grow in this country, both in adults and in children.
Fred, thank you so much. I love the system.
I'm glad.
The challenges that you give to conventional thinking are just amazing.
Yeah, well, someone's got to do it.
Well, I'm glad you're doing it.
All right, thank you so much.
Commentary. Let's review the conventional thinking that Fred Hahn turned upside down. According to Mr. Hahn, forget aerobics and lots of reps. The best way to build muscles is to challenge them to exhaustion. There is more benefit to doing exercises in slow motion than there is to fast movements that take advantage of momentum and don't tax the muscles as much. Most athletic pursuits may actually be harmful, but may be worth pursuing for enjoyment. Stretching makes joints less stable. Strength training improves flexibility anyway. Exercise does little to improve the heart or lungs. Rather, exercise makes muscles more efficient in extracting oxygen and nutrients. Stronger muscles are more flexible. The key to weight loss is limiting carbohydrates. Cholesterol and saturated fats have been given a bad rap and aren't necessarily harmful. Grains are hard to digest, have little nutritional value, and leach minerals. And the dietary requirement for carbohydrates, according to the government, is zero. Some other points he made included: our muscles atrophy with age unless we use them. Muscles are recruited in sequence, with fast twitch muscles being the last to be recruited. We cannot gain new muscles, only strengthen the ones we already have. Most of weight loss comes from nutrition, not exercise. Strength exercise is the best way to build stronger bones. Genetics plays a big role in athletic skills and athletic physique. Most people are not capable of having bodybuilder muscles no matter how much they exercise. Strength training will not make women look muscular, and our bodies are very efficient and require proof its limits are taxed before enhancing muscles. Is he right? I hope so. Physical fitness and nutrition are a tower of Babel with so many conflicting theories and opinions. What matters most is results. I've started doing these slow burn exercises, and I'll give them a 2-month trial. I'll report back later in my experience. As for eschewing carbohydrates, I'm doing some more research. The A to Z study he cited is in the March 2007 issue of the prestigious Journal of the American Medical Association. I'll put a link to information on it on my website, agelesslifestyles.com. You are listening to Ageless Lifestyles on webtalkradio.net and permanently archived on agelesslifestyles.com. For information on my books, Defy Aging and 52 Baby Steps to Grow Young, my anti-aging hypnosis CDs, personal coaching, and my keynote and seminar services, just go to notaging.com or drbricky.com, drbricky.com. I'd love to hear your comments and suggestions. Send them to radio@agelesslifestyles.com. This is your anti-aging psychologist, Dr. Michael Bricky, thanking you for joining us on our quest to live longer, healthier, and happier.